This middle chapter of the unit includes some important historical breakthroughs with respect to DNA, including this first one, which I'll talk about the specific experiment in a second, but let's just think about where we are in history. Obviously, DNA is the genetic material. We've known that for a while now. We continue to learn about DNA, and everyone in the world knows about DNA, whether they know specifically how it works biologically. They know that DNA is the genetic, the material of inheritance, right? Well, that's only pretty recently that we've had this knowledge, only in the last 80 years or so. So one lifetime of humans out of the whole human history. But for millennia, for thousands of years, humans have known that parents pass traits on to their offspring. Right? That's just common knowledge. It's just that we haven't known until recently how this happens. Well, it's reasonable to think that there is some sort of material involved. In other words, that there is a particle of inheritance that gets passed on. But once again, you can't just assume something is true because it makes sense in science. You have to demonstrate it. And this first important experiment that we're looking at in this show indirectly shows that. This is the so-called Griffiths experiment. Happened back in the 40s, 1940s. It was the first, its experiment is famous for a couple reasons. It was the first experiment to demonstrate what is called bacterial transformation. Which I'll explain the definition of in a minute. But it also indirectly demonstrated that there is a particle of inheritance. Direct evidence for that. And this experiment used bacteria and mice. Now, the bacterium being used here has two strains. The so-called S strain and the R strain. So there's two types, even though it's the same species, more or less, of bacterium. There are two types. S stands for smooth because of how it looks under a microscope. But the S version is the dangerous stuff because it causes pneumonia. So dangerous to mammals, including mice or humans. The R cells, the R version of the bacterium, does not do that. It's not virulent, so it's not harmful to us. So let's look at these groups. In the first group, they took living S cells, that's the dangerous ones, and injected them into unwilling mice. And not surprisingly, they died, developed pneumonia and died. So that's perfectly as expected. In the second group, they took living R cells, those are the harmless ones, and also not unexpectedly, the mice did not die. No surprise. In the third group, they took S cells, which are the dangerous ones, but before injecting them, they boiled the suspensions to kill the S cells. And also, not surprisingly, those mice did not die. Dead bacteria don't cause pneumonia. Living bacteria do. All right? It's the fourth one that is surprising and most important result. They took S cells and killed them just like in the third one, but then they mixed those dead S cells with living R cells, which are the harmless ones. And the mice died, even though there were no living S cells to cause their death. So what happened here, as I said, is actually transformation, bacterial transformation. This is a process in which naked DNA, meaning DNA that's no longer in a cell, dead cells that have exploded and just spilled their DNA molecules out into the environment. That naked DNA, under the right circumstances, can be taken up by living bacteria into their cell, and they can start using that DNA as their own, like they had it the whole time. And therefore, by bacterial transformation, a bacterium can have suddenly new traits because it has new DNA. Well, this is exactly why the R cells, by taking up the bacterium from dead S cells, became S cells themselves and caused the bacteria, caused the pneumonia. All right, so it's not only a demonstration of bacterial transformation, it is direct experimental evidence that there is a molecule of inheritance, a molecule that determines a cell's traits. So this says, yes, there is a particle of inheritance or a molecule. It does not at all say what it is, but this is a big step. Now we no longer have to assume that there is a particle of inheritance. And therefore, as soon as this experiment was completed, then biologists immediately wanted to know what the particle of inheritance is, now that we've pinned down that there is such a thing. Well, that took over a decade to figure out, but that brings us to another experiment. Slide 2 shows you what looked like cartoon aliens, these teal-colored things, sitting on this brown thing. Well, the brown thing, as you see, is a bacterial cell, so the bacterium, we're really close up, because this is just a tiny piece of the bacterial cell. These alien-looking things, though, are copies of a virus. And a virus, first of all, is not an organism. Why is it not an organism? Yeah.
Because it's non-living.
Yeah, that's kind of the same thing. Why is it not living? What prevents it from living? And what is it that allows any organism to live? What does it not have that every organism has? No, it has organic molecules. What is the bare minimum requirement for being an organism? What is the structural unit of life? The cell. Right. To be an organism, you have to have at least one cell. Only organisms have cells. All organisms have cells. A virus isn't close to having a cell. Remember that a bacterium is tiny. It's a small, much smaller cell than a normal cell of your body. And a virus is not even close to being that complex. It doesn't have its own membrane. It doesn't have a cytoplasm. It doesn't have a metabolism. In fact, it is just, in the simplest cases like this, two of the four macromolecules. It's a nucleic acid, either a DNA or an RNA, wrapped in a protein. And by itself, it does nothing. It can't reproduce, it can't metabolize, but if a cell gets infected by it, a cell can be fooled into making copies of the virus, and that's how they get reproduced. They don't reproduce themselves. There's all kinds of different viri, but the ones shown here are examples of what are called bacteriophages. And notice that that has the same root as in phagocytosis, which means eat, right? Well, a bacteriophage is not something that eats bacteria, even though that's what the word means. A bacteriophage is a virus that invades bacteria or infects bacteria. A bacteriophage is not a bacterium. The bacterium gets infected with a bacteriophage, the virus. Okay, now, we can see that DNA of the virus gets injected into the bacterium. And this is not a spoiler, because you already know that how this is going to turn out. We already know nowadays that the particle of inheritance is DNA. But in this second experiment I'm about to talk about, we did not yet know that. So this is when we knew there was a particle of inheritance and we wanted to find out what that is. Well, it could be just about anything, right? But to make it easier to check on things, you try to eliminate things that seem to be obviously not a candidate for being the genetic material. So like water molecules or things like that. Simple molecules, they basically just put those to the side and said it's probably one of the four biological macromolecules, which at this time we knew all organisms consisted of. So we knew there were nucleic acids, polysaccharides, polypeptides, and lipids. And three of those that we already also knew what they did, at least to an extent. We knew what lipids and polysaccharides and proteins did. Well, even more screening took place, and they said, let's also exclude from consideration lipids. They're unlikely to be, because they're not as complex as the other three, right? They're not polymers. And let's exclude polysaccharides. Those are mostly fuels and structural items. It's not to say it's impossible for them to be genetic material, but like I said, they needed a starting place. So they kind of put those two off the consideration table. Leaving just two, proteins and DNA. Well, at this point in history, most biologists just figured that it would end up being protein that is the genetic material, which is why they kept it in the running. And the train of thought here was, for something to be controlling something as complex as inheritance, it must be itself a very complex particle, like a protein. So most of the biologists just were assuming that it was going to be protein. And the only reason they also kept DNA in consideration was simply because they knew DNA was in all organisms and they didn't know anything else that it did. So they said, maybe let's test this as well. Okay, so you narrowed it down to either proteins or DNA. And that's exactly why this next experiment used bacteriophages in the experiment. Because a bacteriophage is nothing other than protein and DNA, the two things that you're trying to test. So it boils down to basically figuring out, what gets injected into the bacterium? Is it the protein or is it the DNA? Because what gets injected into the DNA is the genetic material. Yes, we know it's DNA, but at the time we didn't. Let's look at the setup of the actual experiment. Slide 3. Very, very well-designed experiment. They used these bacteriophages, like I said, which are DNA and protein, but they needed to be able to track where the protein is and where the DNA is. They're together at first in the intact virus, but one gets injected and one stays behind, and they need to figure out which is which. So they need to label these two different kinds of particles. And they used a labeling technique called radio labeling because it involves radioactive atoms, radioactive isotopes of certain atoms. In the pink batch, they used radioactive sulfur. Now, that was a perfect choice because no DNA contains sulfur. DNA is made up of nucleotides, right? There's no sulfur in phosphate. There's no sulfur in the sugar. There's no sulfur in the nitrogenous bases. On the other hand, even though not every amino acid contains sulfur, some do. And therefore, proteins, which is a bunch of amino acids, are going to contain sulfur. And if all you have is a sulfur availability is the radioactive version, as you let more and more generations of viruses be created by the bacteria, then that means the protein that makes up part of the virus is going to be radioactive sulfur. Okay, in other words, the radioactive sulfur labels the protein of the virus, but not the DNA. In the blue batch, they use a different radioisotope, radioactive phosphorus, to label just the DNA, but not the protein. Phosphorus is a good choice as well, right? Because however big a DNA strand is, it's made up of a bunch of nucleotides, and each individual nucleotide has a phosphate group in it, which of course includes a phosphorus atom. So if you only have radioactive phosphorus atoms to work with, that means the DNA gets labeled with radioactivity, and the protein doesn't in that batch. Okay, that's the difference between the pink and the blue. And they simply let bacteria become infected, which means create more and more viruses, viral copies. Then they needed a way to break off these empty shells, whatever they were, because they didn't know whether it was the protein or DNA left behind as the shells. You needed to break those off, but do so in such a way that you don't kill the bacterial cells. And so the tool that ended up being perfect for the job is just an ordinary bar blender. It stirs the suspension vigorously enough that these empty shells, after the virus injects into the cell, get broken off of the surface of the cells. They're on their own, but not so vigorously that it'll burst the bacterial cells. So it was just perfect. And then from each of these two batches, pink and blue, they put a sample into a centrifuge, which spins the hell out of them, creating G-forces. The heaviest part in the tube drops to the bottom, and the lighter stuff floats above it. Well, the heaviest stuff by far is the cells, the bacteria. And that makes the pellet in both tubes, but red and blue. The light stuff includes all these empty shells. That's making up what's called the supernatant, the part that floats above the pellet. And then they used their radiation detectors to figure out what was in the pellet and the supernatant in each batch. They looked for the radioactivity. Well, in the pink batch, the radioactivity was found in the supernatant. That's where the empty shells are, right? And pink labeled the protein, not the DNA. So this showed you just by itself that it was not the protein that was injected into the cells. The cells are down here in the pellet. The protein was left behind. In the blue batch, though, the radioactivity was found in the pellet, which is where the cells are. The blue labels the DNA, not the protein. So this batch showed you that what was injected into the cells was the DNA, not the protein. And therefore, the genetic material is DNA, not protein, which surprised most of the biologists at the time because they were all assuming it was going to be protein. As a matter of fact, there were biologists at the time who said more or less, well, what you have demonstrated is that DNA is the genetic material for bacteria, but for something complicated like a human, I'm still betting that it's protein. You know, they were proven wrong shortly thereafter, and we all know that regardless of organism, it's DNA that's the genetic material, not protein. Okay, well, let's take a look at protein. I mean, at DNA. Actually, this is not an entire DNA for two reasons. One is that a whole DNA consists of two strands, not just one, and we're looking at one strand here. Another is that we're not even looking at a whole strand here. This is just four nucleotides long. It's just part that's why it fades from blue to white on both ends. It's just part of a strand. A typical DNA has millions of nucleotides hooked end to end, not just four. But however big a DNA polynucleotide is, we're looking at a polynucleotide here, right? Which is a polymer made out of monomers called nucleotides. However long a polynucleotide is, it is an end-to-end arrangement of nucleotides. Unbranching, just like a polypeptide. It's an end-to-end arrangement of amino acids. A polynucleotide is an end-to-end arrangement of nucleotides. And the reason they're showing you a length of four nucleotides is to remind you of what we've already talked about, namely that DNA uses four kinds of nucleotides normally. And the only reason that there are different kinds of nucleotides is because of the nitrogenous bases. So we have one nucleotide labeled here on the bottom. Each of these other three is one nucleotide as well by itself. But recall what the requirements of being a nucleotide are. You have to have three ingredients, right? You have to have a pentose sugar, a five-carbon sugar. Well, you have a choice if all you're saying is that you have to make a nucleic acid, because there's two kinds of nucleic acids, right? RNA and DNA. But here we're looking at DNA, so if you are determined to make a DNA, then you really don't have a choice of pentose sugars, right? For it to be a DNA polynucleotide, you have to use specifically deoxyribose as the pentose sugar. And however long that polynucleotide is, every one of the nucleotides is going to have deoxyribose as the sugar. In other words, the sugar component of a nucleotide does not give you any variability. It doesn't give you different kinds of nucleotides. The second component is a phosphate hooked to that sugar. Well, all phosphates are the same. So, just like the sugar is not different from nucleotide to nucleotide within a DNA, neither is the phosphate. The only reason that there are different kinds of nucleotides is that there are different kinds of nitrogenous bases, which is the third component. And there are four of those normally possible for DNA: adenine, thymine, guanine, and cytosine, as we can see here. That's really important because DNA is an informational molecule. It carries information. But what is the information? Well, the information is the specific sequence of nucleotides, which really means the specific sequence of nitrogenous bases, since they're the only things that can be different from one another. All right? Now, this sequence is only information if the sequence is maintained. If you lose that sequence, you've lost the information. That's why it's so important for a polynucleotide to be held strongly together along its length. And what you see in this figure is that these nitrogenous bases, which are what gives the polynucleotide its information, are not at all involved in keeping the strand together along its length. They're not hooked to each other within the strand, right? They're just hanging off of the blue part, blue background, which is the sugar phosphate backbone. So called because it's made up of covalent bonds between the phosphate of one nucleotide and the sugar of the next, and then its phosphate will hook to the sugar of the next, and so on. Those individual bonds between adjacent nucleotides, between the phosphate of one and the sugar of the next, are called phosphodiester bonds. And those are covalent bonds and therefore strong. It's really important for those bonds to be strong, because if they were easily broken, then you would lose the information, right? because the code would just be a bunch of letters not connected to each other anymore. You would lose the sequence. So really important for the sugar phosphate backbone to be strong and therefore to survive conditions that an organism is going to be subjected to keep the information intact. The nitrogenous bases give the information, but they don't hold the strand together at all. This is entirely analogous to what's happening in a polypeptide structurally. A polypeptide is also a sequence of monomers, except it's amino acids instead of nucleotides, right? But remember that the only reason you have different kinds of amino acids is because of the R group, right? You remember that? But the R groups are not at all holding the polypeptide together. They're just hanging off of the part that holds it together. What holds together the polypeptide are the peptide bonds that hold. Each peptide bond is a bond between the amino group of one amino acid and the carboxyl group of the next one. And the R groups are just hanging off of that, not interacting with each other at all. Same way here, you have nitrogenous bases just hanging off of the sugar phosphate backbone. While we're still here, also notice that although there are four kinds of nitrogenous bases normally used in DNA, adenine, thymine, guanine, cytosine, there are two categories with respect to how many rings they're made up of. They all have rings, but thymine and cytosine have one ring each only, whereas adenine and guanine each have two rings. That'll be important in a little bit. First, let's go to five. So after we demonstrated experimentally that DNA is the genetic material, then the big burning question became, what does DNA look like? Because obviously you eventually want to figure out how DNA works as an inheritance molecule, but you can't figure out how a molecule works until you first know what its structure is. And that was the big question then, until the mid-50s. So another decade or so until we figured out what the molecule looks like. And that's what Watson and Crick at the time were given credit for, all the credit, and they won the Nobel Prize for it, even though they were substantially helped by this woman, Rosalind Franklin. In modern textbooks, she's given credit, although she never really received any in her lifetime because she died of cancer at age 37. But they couldn't do it without her. She was helpful because she was an expert in what's called X-ray crystallography. And that's a technique used to figure out the shapes of molecules that you don't already know the shapes of. It's called X-ray crystallography because X-ray, which is light but just invisible to us, is shown onto molecules, and then there is X-ray sensitive film at the other end. And depending on the shape of the molecules, these X-rays are going to be refracted differently and create different patterns when the X-rays finally make it to the X-ray film. This is a famous photograph of one of these X-rays. And this doesn't look like much to us, but to Rosalind Franklin, who was a world expert in crystallography, she said, this pattern to me looks like it might be a helix we're looking at. And so that's what she told Watson and Crick, who took her advice and got busy trying to figure out how they could build a helical shape to a DNA molecule. And there's a famous picture of them with a tin model that they, the first model of DNA ever built, they made out in their lab. Well, we can see a cartoon of that double helical model in slide 6 on the left. So this is a single DNA, but that, remember, means that there are two separate molecules in one DNA. And that's because each polynucleotide, each strand in the double-stranded DNA, is by itself a complete molecule. There are two strands here. We can see that because there are two sugar phosphate backbones, each represented by a blue ribbon, showing you that that's what holds it together along its length. And then sticking out from the sugar phosphate backbone are the nitrogenous bases. There's nitrogenous bases for each strand. And overall, you have a double helix. One helix is a corkscrew shape. Each strand is a helix. But there's two strands, so it's a double helix. And the nitrogenous bases that are hanging off from each strand are interacting with each other. They're interacting with nitrogenous bases that are sticking off of the other strand. And that's what holds the two strands together. This is very similar to a multimeric protein. Specifically, a multimeric protein consisting of two polypeptides. Any multimeric protein, remember, consists of two or more polypeptides. Well, a polypeptide by itself is a complete molecule. Just like a polynucleotide or one strand is a molecule in its own right. But in a multimeric protein, the two polypeptides are hooked together somehow to make that more complex protein. The way these two polynucleotides, each its own molecule, are hooked together in a DNA is represented by these pink dots, and those are hydrogen bonds between pairs of nitrogenous bases, one from each of the two strands. Now, hydrogen bonds, you already know, are very weak, right? Individually, very weak. There are millions of them, though, because there are millions of nucleotides making up the DNA. And so it holds the two strands together well, but not too well. Just as I said, it was important for the phosphodiester bonds to be covalent to make up the sugar phosphate backbone, because you need to hold that strand together along its length under all tolerable conditions, otherwise you lose the information. It's also really important for the bonds holding the two strands together to be weak and therefore easily broken, because each of the two major functions of DNA requires the two strands to be separated from each other temporarily. What are those two functions? Yeah. Yes, transcription and replication are the two functions of DNA. In transcription, you're reading just one gene, which is just a little subsequence of the overall sequence. But in order to do that, in order to read the code, you need to separate the two strands from each other. That's why it's important that they be easily broken bonds. Those are hydrogen bonds. Okay? And when you're done reading it, they'll snap right back into place because they match up and will form hydrogen bonds again. You're just temporarily unzipping them. Replication, you use the entire length, so you have to read that whole sequence, but you have to separate the two strands from each other for that as well. So it's important for the sugar phosphate backbone to be strong, covalent, and it's important for the bonds between the base pairs, as they're called, to be weak, hydrogen bonds. How the DNA looks in reality is this double helical model, which is more or less like a spiral staircase. And each step in the spiral staircase is a pair of bases, nitrogenous bases, one from each of the two strands. So that's why we call them base pairs. A base pair makes one step, though, in this spiral staircase. Well, if you mentally untwist that spiral staircase, what you have is a ladder instead, like in the middle. So this is not how it really looks, but it's easier to look at when it's not spiral. And a couple things that you see in the middle are that, well, I should have mentioned earlier that a single polynucleotide of DNA has polarity. Nothing to do with charge, once again. It just means two ends are different from each other. There is a so-called 5' end and a so-called 3' end. The primes are based on what the nearest carbon is in the sugar. So, in this pentose sugar, not every one of the corners is a carbon. Notice if you don't have anything labeled, then you assume that a corner is a carbon. But if it's some other symbol, then it's that other atom. So there's an oxygen here. Well, oxygen is O, of course, but O kind of looks like a zero. So you can kind of think of that as a zero and then start counting positive numbers for all the carbons clockwise from that. 1, 2, 3, 4, and then hanging off of the ring is carbon 5. That's the 5 prime carbon. And however long a polynucleotide is, one end of it will be the so-called 5 prime end, which will have a phosphate connected to that carbon. The other end is a 3 prime end, where there is no phosphate. Instead, associated with the 3 prime end, or the 3 prime carbon, is a hydroxyl group. All right? So each strand by itself has a 3 prime end and a 5 prime end. The overall DNA, which is both strands, exhibits what's called an anti-parallel arrangement. That means that the direction of one strand is the opposite the direction of the other strand. Kind of a head-to-tail arrangement. You see that the 5 prime end is shown as on the top for the left strand. Well, it's the bottom for the right strand. So they go in opposite directions. That's anti-parallel arrangement. And you can also see that not only are there hydrogen bonds forming between base pairs, one from each of the two strands, but it's not just any old pair of nucleotides that form hydrogen bonds. There is what is called complementarity to DNA. That's the noun. We can also say that the two strands of DNA are complementary as an adjective. What that means is that wherever you have an adenine nitrogenous base sticking out at a position on one strand, at that same position on the other strand, you always have a thymine. Adenine always goes with thymine, thymine always with adenine. If you have a cytosine sticking out, the same position on the other strand will have a guanine. Guanine always goes with cytosine, cytosine always goes with guanine. That is complementarity. And that is really important because that is what allows DNA to self-replicate. The reason that DNA is able to make an exact copy of itself is because of complementarity, which will make more sense as we go on, but complementarity is really important. Now, in 7, we get back to this fact that some nitrogenous bases have 2 rings, some have 1. So there's 4 overall kinds of DNA nitrogenous bases. But there are 2 categories based on how many rings they have. And the ones that have 2 rings are called purines. The ones that have 1 ring are called pyrimidines. And I remember always forgetting which was which until it dawned on me one day that the word pyrimidine has a Y in it, and so do the words thymine and cytosine, which are the 2 kinds of pyrimidines. So that has helped me ever since. On the other hand, adenine and guanine don't have any Y in them, and neither does the word purine, which they are examples of. All right, so those are the categories. And this slide brings up another important historical figure, a guy called Chargaff, who studied DNA from a huge variety of organisms. all major groups of organisms, from bacteria to whales to whatever. And what he would then analyze them chemically, the DNA samples from different organisms he would analyze chemically. And one thing that popped out to him was that no matter what organism he got his DNA from, that sample always had the same amount of purine as it had pyrimidine. That came to be known as Chargaff's rule. Well, this figure shows you why, using this ladder. So this is untwisted DNA into a ladder. If you allowed any nitrogenous base to bond with any nitrogenous base in the other strand, then you could have some rungs of the ladder be made out of two purines, some made out of two pyrimidines, and some being made out of one of each. But since purines have two rings, they are wider. And if you made a rung or a step of the ladder out of two purines, it would be wider than a step made out of two pyrimidines. So instead of having a ladder with parallel vertical parts, it would be zigzag, right? It wouldn't be a normal ladder. And that's why it doesn't happen. On the other hand, if you always have every rung made out of one purine and one pyrimidine, doesn't matter which one's on which side, it's always going to be the same length, same width of the rung, all the way up the ladder. And that's why that happens. So that explains part of complementarity. That tells you why it's always purine with pyrimidine, which is true. But that's only part of complementarity. It's more strict than that. It's not only that it's always one purine with one pyrimidine, it is always specifically adenine with thymine and guanine with cytosine, which is more than just purine with pyrimidine, right? Well, let's look at why that happens in slide 8. Adenine is a purine, thymine is a pyrimidine, but if the only requirement is purine with pyrimidine, then adenine as a purine could also bind with cytosine, a pyrimidine. It doesn't happen that way, though, because adenine and thymine are both able to make two hydrogen bonds, the pink dots, whereas guanine and cytosine are each able to make three hydrogen bonds. So that's what makes them perfect matches for each of these two pairs. All right? And that's really important, because unless you have strict complementarity, then you're not going to end up making the exact copy of DNA when you replicate it. That's kind of explained in slide 9. In Watson and Crick's paper, it ends with a statement. I can't remember what the exact statement is, but it's really an understatement where when they finally figured out this, how to build the molecule, they said they noticed this complementarity. It's always A with T and C with G. And they wrote something like, it has not escaped our attention that this complementarity lends itself well to a replication mechanism or something like that, which is exactly what happened. That was a big thing that came from their work. We can see that when we look at a little piece of DNA in dark blue here. Dark blue means the original DNA material. The thing about strict complementarity is that if you have a double-stranded DNA and you take away one strand and hide it from me, but you let me see the sequence of the other one, then I don't need the sequence in the one you're hiding from me. I can tell you exactly what it is because of the rules of complementarity, right? Just reading this one, I can tell what this sequence has to be complementary. And therefore, DNA, each strand in a double-stranded DNA molecule by itself serves as a template for how to build a copy of the other strand. And this is how replication happens. So the dark blue is old original material. Like I said, you have to separate the two to read those strands. So that's shown in B here. And then once you separate the two strands, each is by itself acting as a code for how to build a copy of the other one. And the light blue material is the new DNA strand that's built simply by reading the original sequence in this strand and using complementarity rules. Has to be T, G, A, T, C to correspond to this. Meanwhile, in the other strand, the same thing's happening. So when both of those things occur, what you end up with are two identical copies of double-stranded DNA. Enough to give to each of two cells when a cell splits. And this is why life exists. You have to have this ability to replicate the molecule exactly, and DNA has that ability because of strict complementarity. I think I'll stop there.